Well, we're in the midst of our somewhat difficult study, and I'm torn between being apologetic for it and, on the other hand, don't apologize for it. But the information that we have here, I'm trying to compress into three lessons. Actually, it was more than that, but rather than have you read a 600-page book. And that's not gonna, you're not going to read the 600-page book, I'm sure, or a few others. So we're working on the subject of, for some of you that haven't been here, we look at the Bible as a contract rather than a story. You know, some people look at the Bible, a lot of nice stories. And so it's not a storybook. It's a contract. If you're going to classify what the Bible is, it's a contract. And we've been following it along on that basis. So part of it is the contract says that God gave Abraham the land, and then it also says that I will bring you back into it, and that means on a permanent basis. So here's a little clip that I've got for you this morning that sets it up.
By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept as we remembered Zion. For those who carried us away captive asked of us a song, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? But now, thus says the Lord, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by your name. You are mine. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel. I have loved you, therefore I will give men for you and people for your life. I will bring your descendants from the east and gather you from the west. I will say to the north, give them up, and to the south, do not keep them back. Bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth.
Anyway, that's kind of a nutshell. It comes out Isaiah 43, starts out the Babylon captivity, but ends up in the final restoration at the end of what we call the end of the church age or into the millennium. So it says, in a sense, what we're doing here. God started out with these promises. I'll give you the land. Same God that says, let there be light, also said to Abraham, I give this to you. And we find that it's divided into land, seed, and blessing aspects of a contract. So a little bit of background, just to go through this quickly. There's so little time in our time, but I got to go through the background and get this set up. Remember the whole picture of God. You step back and look at what God is doing in the world. We have two failed attempts for man to get it right. One is at the creation, one is the Tower of Babel. So the Lord of the universe determines not to leave the effort to restore righteousness to his creation in the hands of sinful men. He's going to have to take charge. In order for him to restore righteousness, he will choose one man and his wife to bring about what cannot be accomplished by mere mortals. What God does is not in secret, by the way. It's not in the secret annals of heaven, but is done in broad daylight for the benefit of the created worlds. We have it described in a statement of God's intention or intervention, and we call it a contract, where he repeats many, many times, I will, which in this case is an obligation of God's future conduct. And that's what a contract does. It obligates your future. Surprising about this contract, the obligation falls singularly to the maker of it, whereas the recipient of its provision has no obligation as to securing it or maintaining its ownership. To capture its purpose, the contract spells out the parties, the duration, and the provision of it, and we have abbreviated, as we have on the board, land, seed, and blessing. The conditions or terms of the contract are to be literally understood. There's no figures here. It is unilaterally made by God, one-sided. It is eternal in its duration, and it can never be abrogated. And all this evidences that it has an unconditionality to it. And the contract is limited primarily to Abraham and his descendants, to Isaac and Jacob. Therefore, the account of the Bible is not a story, Dwayne, He didn't like stories. He didn't think the Bible's a story. It's not a story, but it is a contract with biting, ironclad, unbreakable conditions, and that's why people have a hard time with it. They want it to be flexible. Now, our byline to the title is, since we live in 2018, we can actually ask the question, well, how did it work out? How did this work out? How did the contract in its ironclad nature work out? Now, we aren't in a perspective where we can make some observations about this. Not true many years ago. So we will take the seed and blessing part of the contract in turn, so we can leave that in our future study, but we're still focusing now then on the land portion. How did it work out? Remember, since the diaspora, the scattering of the Jews, after the Roman destroyed the temple and then Hadrian destroyed the city, 135 AD, the Jews have been vagabonds in the world. We have plants named after them even. The Jewish promises have been lost or rejected by the Christian world, second century. This is a very, very important issue. The Christians rejected the Jews out of the Bible, threw them out of the Bible, and put themselves in its place as God's blessed people. So, millennium later, it was in England that the first ideas of Jewish restoration began with the translation of the Bible into English, and they had it given into the hands of the people, hand-copied from the Latin Vulgate. We know by Wycliffe was martyred about 1300 B.C. That's what started with the English. That's where it started in the world, actually. Henry VIII, 1535, made Bible reading popular, even chained it to the pulpits in England for 2 years. And then another 100 years later, the Puritans struggled to recover the Jewish promises. Some did, some did not. Mixed bag here. But Oliver Cromwell, under the Protectorate, allowed the Jews back into Britain in 1656. So they were, in a sense, the first in this line of accepting Jews in a modern era. So a string of British leaders made serious the question of Jews returning to their land. And that is called Christian Zionism, or Zionism is just a return to the land. You can be Jewish, you can be non-Jewish, you can be Gentile, you can be Christian, you can be pagan, but Zionism is returning to the land. That's all it is. So Christian Zionism starts to gather steam. In about the middle of the 19th century, Lord Shaftesbury, Arthur Balfour in the beginning of the 20th century, and then, by the way, these last two were prime ministers, David Lloyd George, at the end of World War I. Those are from the Gentile side. They're all British leaders. They're all evangelical. They believed there was a future for Israel. They didn't understand how this would work out, but they thought somehow, and in the psyche of the British population and in its leadership particularly, there was this idea that they were going to play a role in this restoration. Then we have the Jewish leaders. We have Theodor Herzl, who began the Zionist movement in 1897 in Basel. Was a Jewish guy in England. Well, first Russia and in England. And then Nahum Sokola, also a Jewish guy, ends up in England. These are important people before the nation is formed. Now, recently, we have talked about the importance of the Balfour is how you say it, and I never can get it right because the A is the E. The Balfour Declaration made by Arthur Balfour on behalf of the British government in a letter to David Rothschild to assist in establishing a Jewish homeland in Palestine. This is written November 2, 1917, 1 year before the end of World War I, and in anticipation of the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. Remember, Allenby had just taken Gaza, and he was moving on to take Jerusalem. And that gave the British enough confidence that the war was going to be won on their behalf, and Britain was going to be in a position to do something with the land. So that's when the Balfour Declaration was given, or was made, sent to Rothschild. So this is written November 2, 1917, a year before the end of the war, in anticipation of the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, who have held sway over this land since, let's say, 1453, when the Byzantine Empire ended. So it's been under Muslim control all these years. The British intentions, now what all has to happen, and we have just given you just a few pieces. There are millions and kajillions, if that's a word, of things that have to line up for all this to work out. But the idea is that there are many elements that have to be worked out that is beyond human control, any human design, any human management, any human skill or power or money could ever do. It is something that's done in the way God does things. So I just listed some major things. First of all, this intention must be sincere on the part of the British. The Western international nation, this is something that's not understood. That's why I'm doing this lesson. The Western international nations must agree to the idea of a homeland, in other words, the state of Israel. It wasn't a British idea or ended with a British idea. In fact, we're the last one to get on board. We have to have the Jewish people support the idea because the Jewish people have been so maligned that they could no longer stand another opportunity of getting back into the land and be displayed one more time. So they resisted it by more than the majority. The land had to be freed from the Ottomans and must be placed in some kind of transitionary state where there can be an oversight of another nation while another nation, the Jewish nation, is formed and becomes established as a nation with its governments and with its laws, with its administration. You don't make that up overnight. Then all this has to be there for the Jewish nation to become established. And the process began in Britain in late 1914, about the time of World War I. Remember, World War I was made, a stupid war, was fought to free the land for the Jews. World War II was fought to free the people for the land. I mean, we think about those are horrendous costs, especially World War I, which is such an idiotic war, ending up with this purpose, all of a sudden it makes sense. Now, as it is often said, but the British did not make a land grab. Correcting misconceptions, the British did not force the idea of Zionism on the Allied powers after World War I. The Balfour letter was issued only after nearly 3 years of intense lobbying for a Jewish state that included the Western nations involved in the war. It was Britain, the United States, who were the last to sign on to the idea. Even the British then had to grapple with the language at the 11th hour, end of October. So I could have saved you all that and just showed you this. Abraham was told, I will give you this land. And then in the meantime, we have Ezekiel saying what's going to happen to it. And the enemies of the land of God say, because the enemy has spoken against you, Israel, aha, the everlasting heights have become our possessions. So 4,000 years later, we have this commitment that God made in 2000 BC approximately. 4,000 years, God now makes good his commitment. In 1948, Israel established and as an independent nation, the first time actually since 586 BC when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem. Never were independent nation until 1948. Now think about that if you're going to think about something as a fulfilled prophecy. There aren't very many of these that you see, and there aren't any others, I should say. You have one. I will bring you into the land. And we have this in Ezekiel 36:24. All right, so that's the story. And we're in the middle of this. We went one-third of the way through, and this is another third kind of like. We're going to focus on Sokolow, unknown person, but you look him up, he's there. Sokolow, therefore, this lobbyist, threw himself into lobbying, this diplomacy and propaganda, not a good word for us, but, you know, promoting their idea. Traveling across Europe, must have been by train or by stagecoach. There weren't cars, there were a few, but I don't know how he traveled, but where he traveled, how much he traveled is very impressive. To America, the Ottoman Empire. So in 1911, when he was elected to the Zionist executive in 1914, remember, late of 1914, before the war began, he joined forces with the dynamic young Chaim Weizmann in the campaign to win British recognition of Zionist claims. So we've got two guys working for them. So the beginning of the effort to produce the Balfour Declaration begins with Weizmann, but Sokolow was also given credit because he accomplished what many, including Weizmann, thought was impossible. Now, 4 years ahead, during the spring of 1917, He secured the explicit and in writing, in some cases, the tacit assent of the French, Italian governments, and even the Roman Catholic Pope to the Jewish national home under Jewish British auspices. He accomplished that. Well, how did he surprise everyone, including Weizmann, by his achievement? Why has all this been forgotten? That's a good question. All this is still another 3 years before Balfour in 1917 and 4 years before the horrible war ends. Sokolov has streets and kibbutz named after him, but his contribution to the Jewish homeland has largely fallen into the convenience of a forgotten memory. It is unlikely that war with the Arabs could ever have been avoided, but a good understanding of the process that led to the Jewish state would have produced fewer distractions to the Jewish cause. So the story continues. While Weizmann was a public figure, it was Sokolov who should be given the national recognition, I repeat this again, because he accomplished what many thought impossible during the spring of 1917, before Balfour. He secured explicit and tacit assent of the French, of the Italian governments, and even the Catholic Pope to a Jewish national home under Jewish auspices. Now, in summary, Sokolov's contribution, it would help us and the world to consider the history that led to the Jewish state. It is not some secret deal forced upon a territory and people without history. None of it was hatched behind closed doors in dark secrecy, when some British and the French did plan secretly, it nearly upset the entire venue. But all of the involved empires first had their private say, which we saw last week. Then it was done in public diplomacy, which we'll do next week. I should say, we'll do it this week, the next week. Yeah, golf 1 week. First of all, privately, and then publicly. You got to do this publicly. If you don't do it publicly, you don't have a deal, which is a new thing. There are no more of these behind-the-closed-doors things. You know, you have to do everything. Well, think about Trump. Everything Trump does these days is in public, ad nauseum. You know, everything is done in the public. That used not to be that way. So the factor played a critical role in the success of the Jewish state, this public thing. Again, understand the key factors to success was that before Balfour was written, the idea of a Jewish state had been publicly, internationally, positively vented by all the allies. It was a done deal before the Balfour letter was ever written. Sokolov understood this, and that's why he went through this process. That process, with his work, to his credit, the plan was exposed to the public. An irony in the fact that the Balfour called for a homeland for the Jews, that's the letter the British wrote, but that which was done in full view of the parties, who in the beginning and in the end supported the idea not just of a homeland, but they expected a Jewish state would emerge. And when Balfour writes it, he pulls back the state idea. Interesting. Europe was ready to go with the whole thing. Give them the land. It's their land. And then when the British write the Balfour, they pull it back. Remember, the Zionists had been functioning as an organization since 1897. Their stated objective was to secure a homeland for the Jews recognized by the nations. The last pogrom in Russia, when the assassination of the Tsar and blamed the Jews for it, was in 1881. The Dreyfus Affair in Paris, where Herzl gets involved in this problem. The Jews are not going to get assimilated, he says, so we've got to take things in our own hand finally. So the Dreyfus Affair in Paris and a similar incident in Damascus urged Zionists to work towards a homeland in their historic place in the Levant, Syria. An attempt to secure the land from the Turkish Sultan failed, and by the way, this was attempted three or four times. I just read another book this last week where I counted at least three of them, three times where they asked the Sultan to at least allow the Jews back in and even live under their auspices, but the Sultans, the Turkish people, would not allow it. That's why the World War I had to occur. You know, gave you a chance to do it peacefully, and God said, you don't do it peacefully, I'll do it violently. So they took attempted to secure the land from the Turkish Sultan failed due to Turkish intransigence and German interference, all this before World War I. All this motivated Zionists to see a positive outcome for the Allies, France, Britain, Italy, Japan, Russia, largely these, and for them. Now, they thought this side, if it would win, we'd better for the Jews than for Germany and Turkey to win. That would be bad for them. So many Jews were in Western Russia, Poland, Prussia, all these names, the boundaries move back and forth there, who were a part of the Allied nation in World War I, but life in Russia was tentative, and they were fearful of the pogroms, yet a fate in the hands of the Allies was hopefully better than be left in the hands of the Ottoman Sultan or the Germans should the Axis powers win. So the Jews were on the Allied side. Now, we're not going to do this again today, but last week talked about the protocols of the elders. Here we could insert the story again. The elevator Jewish powers that assumed to exist due to the forgery of the protocols of the elders of Zion. Therefore, the Jews achieve a quasi-national status because of this false document. They achieve this quasi-national status because of, they think of their influence, which doesn't exist. And they do this without a nation. Sokolov acts as the capable statesman for the Jewish state even before there was one because of the Zionist document, Protocols of Zion. Remember God meant for good. So early in 1917, that year, 1917 is a great year if you're going to write a paper on a year. That's the one to write on. There's so much happened in 1917. The Zionists had one objective. There was no doubt that the best prospects for Zionism lay in a total Allied victory over German-backed Ottomans and the placing of Palestine under the exclusive British protectorate. Only in Britain did Zionism have enough support, Gentile and Jewish, in governing circles to overcome deep-seated opposition from critics and doubters from across Europe. Britain was different. Including among the doubters were influential Jews who were opposed to Zionism. You think they all want to run home? No, many of them, most of them opposed it. They don't want to be disappointed again. And only Britain had the mix of strategic interest, the place in the world, the military power to back up their interest, and the political will to enforce its will in Palestine. But the Zionists, Sokolov and Weizmann, faced two problems before the war's end. And that was this, that Britain had already promised a share of Palestine to its wartime enemies, allies. The Zionists did not know that. So Sokolov is going around not knowing this is under the table. The secret agreement nearly killed the ability for Britain to be the midwife of the Jewish state. As it worked out, the Lord and the second unexpected workaround that kept the Jewish hope alive, remember that Sokolov was not aware of the secret agreement in his negotiating, was in good faith. The secret deal in the spring of 1916, 1 year before we're talking about, Britain and France, Russia had finalized a secret agreement to partition the Ottoman Empire upon its eventual defeat. The Ottomans had been dying for centuries. Now they saw the end of it and they were starting to divide up the corpse. This was the Asia Minor Agreement, commonly known as Sykes-Picot Accord after the British negotiator Mark Sykes and his French counterpart, the diplomat Francis Georges Picot. So the Sykes-Picot Agreement. The agreement. Secret agreements obligated allies. Now think about this. Now if you're France, Italy, you're not in the part of this now. You don't know about this. Secret agreements obligating parties without their knowledge are seeds of more war, which will come from offended nations whose interests were not considered. France and England make a deal, and Italy doesn't have a clue. All right? Doesn't set good with Italy. All right, so the case for more war. The secret agreement divided the Levant and the Mesopotamia between Britain and France, and that little pink line on the board is kind of where that line was drawn. It's kind of like at Haifa, south and north would be French. The secret agreement divided the Levant and the Mesopotamia between Britain and France along an east-west line in the sand from the Mediterranean to the western borders of Persia. Russia was to receive a large swath of eastern Anatolia. Get this out of time here. Remember, 1917 is the time when Russia wins two revolutions. So they're participants in the war in the beginning, but the end of the war, end of 17, they're out of the war. So Russia is a factor, yet it's not a factor. I just throw that in there to let you know where we are in time. Earlier, at least, on the eastern front of the war against the Ottomans, was making better progress than in France, this is Allenby from Britain, Britain was getting ahead of itself in the history and wanted to reserve space for her interests. Because Britain held that Palestinian involved so many conflicting interests, France, that it needed to have a special status. So according to the Sykes-Picot map, the Northern Galilee would go to France at the port of Haifa, and Acre would be allotted to Britain. That's what that pink line was, and the center of the country, including Jerusalem and Jaffa, was to come under international administration, a form of which would be decided upon through consultation with all the rest of the allies after the war. But there's nothing left there for Britain except a little hole in the map, and nothing for the Jews, of all things. So if the Sykes agreement would have been implemented, it might well have destroyed the prospect of Zionism. Weizmann later recalled or described it as fatal to us. Now look, a closer look shows that there was no Jewish homeland in the Sykes-Picot agreement. Yes, a territory under an international administration for Jerusalem and Jaffa, but no Jewish place. The agreement did not include Italy or Russia. No, the secret agreement. This is what was wrong with secret agreements. They must be lived out in public eventually, sooner or later. This complicates the situation in the Levant with British and French, when British and French are making deals with the Jewish land in order to placate and curry the favor of the Arabs in response to their revolt against Ottomans. Now, this is very confusing for people. The Arabs revolted against the Ottomans, the Arabs against Arabs. The Ottomans are so despicable that even the Arabs don't want to live under it. So during World War I, there was a revolt of Arabs against the Ottomans. Just see it that way. And that's where we get Lawrence of Arabia gets involved in here, and Edward R. Murrow puffs them, and they become a national figure, and it's almost romanticized here. All right. So we have Britain begins to make promises to these Arabs that are helping against the Ottomans, who are just barely participating in this war. You read some of this stuff, but they expect all the sand. This is inserted here just to show that Sokolov has a challenge, not knowing what has already been decided, or so it seems he's got to face that. Fortunately for the Zionists, David Lloyd George, who became prime minister at the close of 17 the year before, 17, thought that the Sykes-Picot agreement had given too large a place in Palestine for French. In fact, they didn't get hardly anything. So Britain, after all, would do nearly all the heavy lifting of the dying Ottoman forces, so they thought they should have more of the Sinai and the Palestine. So Sykes, our English guy, was tasked to revisit this secret agreement with the French, the Picot, so that he'd get some of this stuff back. The French, represented by Picot, resisted. It shouldn't be the English that should go. He resisted that. Their own claim to Palestine was at least equal to Britain. So it's just, you know, typical stuff that goes back and forth. But who's going to do this? It was at this moment that Sykes discovered Zionism. Now, this is the British guy. Like, he's been like the giant sleeping for a century. Now he wakes up. And he now finds out, the leading negotiator for the British learns about Zionism in 1917. It seems at first strange enough story. Sokolov later wrote, a certain Sir Martin appears, to make some inquiries and then expresses a wish to meet Zionist leaders. Like, this is a new thing for him. Finally, at a meeting actually takes place and discussions are entered in upon. The meeting took place in the morning of February 7, 1917 in a private home in London. Sykes was there, the most foremost leader of and sympathizers of the Zionist movement. Sokolow, Weizmann, Rothschild, two of them, and Herbert, also a Jewish guy, Herbert Samuel, they're all there for the record of that meeting. It is clear that Sykes held out prospects, the British guy, held out prospects that Britain might gain Zionists some form of recognition. Remember, the Britons are looking out for themselves, but they're also looking out for the Jews. France, he told him, was seriously difficulty. The French wanted all of Syria and a great say in Palestine, and Sykes proposed that Zionists approach the French in order to put the Jewish claims before them, to convince them. So who's going to do this? Who's going to carry the water here? Some of the Zionists in the room resisted the idea, arguing that Britain should be the one that did go, Sykes should be the one that should go. But Sykes thought otherwise. Rothschild finally, the Jew guy, finally replied that Sokolow was the proper person who could speak for the Russian Jews also. So Sykes agreed to induce Sokolow to Pico on the following day. That's how, for the first time, the idea of a Jewish Zionism, the Jewish homeland, gets introduced officially into the discussion of the British and into the world scene. It was here. Remember, Sykes didn't even know about Zionism in 17, after all these years that's been going on. So it's an amazing fact of history that Zionism did not get to express interest in the Levant. Remember, they were offered places in Africa until nearly 20 years after the first Zionist conference in 1897. As World War I continued without USA until April of 17, Jews were invited in by the British. The Jews are invited in by the British. Somewhat unexpectedly, Sykes, who made this inquiry by him, the first asked to begin negotiation with the French to have them give up part of the expected spoils and return them to Britain. So we got to get some of the land away from France and give it to England so they can protect it for the Jews. This task goes to Sokolow, an unlikely choice. With no standing in international dealings, he placed one of the marvels of God again. No international standing, he is placed at the center stage of a critical moment in the Jews achieving nationhood. Yet his status as a Russian Jew helped placate the French. Perhaps the turmoil in Tsarist Russia, the Russia Tsar abdicate early in 17, another thing that happened in that year, gave some sympathy to the Russian Jews, even though the Jews had no standing in Russia. Remember, the pogroms started under the assassination of his father that we're just talking about, the Tsar we're talking about here. So the Sokolow, the person, why was Sokolow the proper person? Well, this is sort of a human thing. Sokolow was the diplomat of the diplomacist of the Zionist movement, the diplomacist of the school of the French Foreign Ministry. Now, here's what the important stuff is. He was handsome in appearance, an air of fine breeding, a distinguished manner, a gentle speech, a calculated expression, cautious action, well-cut clothes. His monocle were faithful to a tradition which perhaps is not so highly honored as before the war. Diplomats and ministers felt that he belonged to their club, spoke their language, was one of themselves who practiced their art, and was entitled to their privileges. While Sokolow represented no state, leaders saw in this little bent Jew, still bearing Russian nationality, an authentic spokesman of the Jewish masses who could move them in the direction of the power of the words. Remember, they think that the Jews run the world, so you got to bow down to the Jews, all made up in those protocols. He seemed to personify what Sachar's called the great Jewish legend, as a cosmopolitan leader of the great Jewry, to which Sykes and others attributed vast subterranean influence. Again, we mentioned the power of the forged, the protocols of the Elders of Zion. And so Sokolow went forth first to engage the Pico in London, French guy in London, then back and forth to Paris, and with an unexpected detour to Rome, all in close coordination with Sykes, the English guy. It was a daunting mission. Sokolow's task was to persuade the French not to just to the feasibility of a Zionist project, but also of the virtues of a British protectorate over Palestine. On the face of it, both propositions should have seemed preposterous to the French. Zionism enjoyed little support among the French Jews. The French had already been promised a share of Palestine. Why would they give it up? So, anyway, this secret agreement is still going on. Yet Sokolow managed not only to disarm suspicions of the Zionist program, he even succeeded in extracting statements of support. After two preparatory meetings with the French, Sokolow headed for Paris, and two separate rounds of talks, he thrice met with the French General Secretary and Foreign Minister and one of the great French diplomats of the day. Second time around, he had an audience with the Prime Minister. To Pico in London, Sokolow had expressed an open preference to British protection. Jew telling the French, we'd like to have the British protect us. Wow. Pico pushed back. In Paris, he instead emphasized the feasibility of a Zionist project. Now, how it animated Jewish opinion in Russia And again, currying the favor of the Jews. You can't say anything about British because they'd be against them, but you talk about the Jews and their favor, that was okay. So the French expressed a general sympathy for Zionism, but Sokolov had the bold temerity to ask for it in writing. This is one of the most incredible places in this whole thing that gets the French to write their commitment out in writing, because they will back out later on and the Jews come out and say, here's the document. And they say, oh, yeah, that's right. I mean, it's one of those little things that wouldn't have happened. All right, I'll tell you that, and I'm going to tell you what I told you. The French expressed a general sympathy for Zionism, but Sokolov had the temerity to ask for it in writing. He received it on October 4, 1917. Cambon issued a letter on the Prime Minister's authority, which not only anticipated the Balfour Declaration, but cleared the way for it. So here's the letter. Now, you are good enough to present the project to which you are devoting your efforts, which has for its object the development of Jewish colonization in Palestine. Remember, this is the French writing to the Jews. This is the commitment of the French to the Jews way before the Balfour letter was ever written. You consider that circumstances permitting and the independence of the holy place to be safeguarded, on the other hand, it would be a deed of justice and reparation to assist by the protection of the Allied powers in the renaissance of the Jewish nationality in that land from which the people of Israel exiled so many centuries ago. This is French talking to the Jews. Official document. The French government, which entered this present war, still going on, to defend a people. Remember, World War I was an attack on France. Defended a people wrongly attacked, and which continues the struggle to assure the victory of right over wrong. But we can feel sympathy for your cause, the triumph of which is bound up in that of the Allies. Then he ends up by saying, I'm happy to give you herewith such assurance. That's worth more than gold. So one has to wonder, after the French had paid so dearly for World War I in Germany, that God was preparing them, and they were somewhat sympathetic to the Jewish cause because of that. Again, what's at some point seems bad, the war works out to the benefit of God's plan later. Good principle never to forget. 5 more minutes, I'm going to quit. What the Balfour did not include became part of the consideration of other nations. The Balfour was weak. The other nations had stronger statements about the Jewish homeland. What Balfour did not include became part of the consideration of other nations as it worked out by design. In content and form, the French was much more favorable to the Zionists than the watered-down formula of the Balfour Declaration that followed it. The French anticipated a rationale. Give the rationale. Why? It's your homeland. The Balfour has no rationale in it. It said they should do it. No reason why. But the French accepted the rationale in terms of justice and reparation and acknowledged the historical Jewish tie to the land. The letter was bound Zionism to the cause of all the Allies and made no reference at all to the rights of the non-Jews in the land. So we expect that, as in international law, it's what they were thinking. It is what is expected here. It is always the case when the belligerent nation loses, their subjects do as well. The citizen status is changed as much as their leaders, who lose their offices and their rights. There were Arabs in the land. They never were expelled. Many did stay to have a better life than they would have under the Ottoman rule. In international law, those that run or turn belligerent have no rights as citizens unless they are granted by the new regime. So there's no rights for the belligerent forces, whether in the land or out of the land. So with the Campbell letter, the Zionists now have a written assurance of French support. France, however, had neither any assistance. No, France got, what did France get out of it? Nothing. France got absolutely nothing out of this. The Zionists now had a written assurance of French support. That was all going to the Jews. France, however, had neither any assurance of Zionist support for France in the land, nor any prospect of obtaining any support for France in the land. The French obstacle to a possible British declaration had been neutralized. It leaves the door open for Britain to move quite on in and become the protectorate. So the use of the Cameron letter to nudge the British, almost reverse psychology here. Our purpose, explained Sokolov, looking ahead, is to receive from the British government, he's talking to the British now, short of approval of the same kind as that which I have been given successfully in getting from the French government. So it plays one against the other. Look what the French did. You ought to do at least that much. On getting back to London, he deposited the Cameron letter in the Foreign Office, where it stimulated a spirit of competition. British officials who sympathized with Zionism now urged the British to go as far as the French. One more. French approval, now the Roman Church. It was not only the Cameron letter that Sokolov secured during his continental sojourn. Yes, yes, the Pope says. Yes, yes, I believe we shall be good neighbors. These words spoken to Sokolov by Pope Benedict XV on May 14, 1917, thoroughly departed from previous Catholic approaches to Zionism or Jewishness. The visit to Rome had been urged by Sokolov by the French and facilitated by the English. They had hoped that they might win over the government of Italy, another ally, but the Catholic Church was no smaller prize. It claimed rights to the holy places all over Palestine and maintained as a matter of theology that the Jews had dispersed as punishment for their refusal to accept Jesus as Messiah. In 1904, Herzl had met Pope Pius X. We have them now on South Street there, right? The school, right, 10th, who told him not, in no uncertain terms, that the Jews have not recognized their Lord, therefore we cannot recognize the Jewish people. And that Latin word non possumus really means no way, Jose. Yet Sokolov, a few years later, had an admirable meeting with Benedict in which the pontiff describes the return to the Jews to Palestine as, the word providential, God has willed it. Sokolov wrote up the exchange verbatim. Sokolov assured that the Zionists would respect the Vatican's immemorial rights over the holy places, and the Pope offered reciprocal assurances. The Italian government gave Sokolov an assurance of its goodwill and sympathy. The Zionists in London hadn't expected Sokolov to go to Rome, or when he did, to gain an audience with the Pope. Only weeks earlier, Weizmann had written to Lord Rothschild that, "I'm afraid the Catholic influence is asserting itself very strongly and is obscuring the political issues." Well, when Weizmann heard that the outcome of the Vatican, he congratulates Sokolov on his brilliant result. So what is so surprising is that at the point, Britain had pledged nothing, so Sokolov could be forgiven for informing Weizmann from Paris that we have achieved here no less, maybe more, than your country where we have been working for nearly 3 years. I got nothing out of my own country, and I got it all from all of these. You know, get on board. In the months that followed, Weizmann and Sokolov worked in tandem with Sykes to close the gap and elicit British declaration to support building on Sokolov's achievement on the continent. The history of these efforts have been researched and analyzed in great depth. Here, too, Sokolov played a major role drafting numerous documents, including the formulation of the proposed formula for the declaration submitted by the Zionists to Balfour. It was Sokolov who coined the term national home. Note, the use of the soft words national home were then not for the benefit of the Allied nations. Must have been for the Arabs, who must have objected to any language of statehood. We must remember that the Allies are not seeing any rights left to the present land occupiers. We call them today the Palestinians. Since all the Ottoman subjects lose their rights in defeat, the avoidance of inflammatory language was therefore avoided by Sokolov, and he was the master of politicians. And there we go now to the United States. But we won't do that till next week.